Okay, but now I
Anyway.
got it.
Yep. Okay, we'll open in prayer. Father, thank you for this day of the resurrection of your Son and our Savior. And we ask that you would be with us tonight and guide our thoughts, our words, give us light on, shed light on these words that we read and study, and guide the conversation. And we will give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, the very first chapter, there's a lot of references to prayer in Samuel. We probably won't even get through the book this time, unlike some of the other ones we've studied recently. And the very first reference has to do with the birth of Samuel. I don't know if we need to read the. Do you think it's worthwhile to read some of the context, or I can read. Yeah, I will. I mean, these are basically a lot of stories. however, there are numerous verses in which in the first chapter that refer to Hannah's praying. I will start with to give you the background. In fact, I can summarize instead of reading all of this. Hannah had no was the wife of Penina. No, Penina was one of his of Elkanah's. He was a wife of Elkanah. Elkanah had two wives, Penina and Hannah. But Hannah had no children, very similar to R Rachel and Leah at one point, where Leah had the children and Rachel didn't. And Hannah feels very insecure, I guess, from this. And it says in verse 4, well, again, like Rachel and Leah, even though Penina was the one who had the children, it says that Hannah was Elkanah's favorite, just like Rachel was the favored one of Jacob. And it says her rival to make her miserable would taunt her that the Lord had closed her womb. This happened year after year. Every time she went up to the house of the Lord, the other would taunt her so that she wept and would not eat. Her husband Elkanah said to her, "Hannah, why are you crying? And why aren't you eating? Why are you so sad? Am I not more devoted to you than 10 sons?" After they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh, Hannah rose. The priest Eli was sitting on the seat near the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. In her wretchedness, she prayed to the Lord, weeping all the while. And she made this vow, "O Lord of hosts, if you will look upon the suffering of your maidservant and will remember me and not forget your maidservant, and if you will grant your maidservant a male child, I will dedicate him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor shall ever touch his head." And she kept on praying before the Lord. Or as she kept on praying before the Lord, Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah was praying in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice could not be heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, "How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Sober up." And Hannah replied, "Oh no, my Lord, I am a very unhappy woman. I have drunk no wine or other strong drink, but I have been pouring out my heart to the Lord. Do not take your maidservant for a worthless woman. I have only been speaking all this time out of my great anguish and distress." "Then go in peace," said Eli, "and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She answered, "You are most kind to your handmaid." So the two women left. She ate and was no longer downcast. Early next morning, they bowed low before the Lord and they went back home to Ramah. Elkanah knew his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. Hannah conceived, and at the turn of the year bore a son. She named him Samuel, meaning "I asked the Lord for him." And when the man Elkanah and all his household were going up to offer to the Lord the annual sacrifice and his votive sacrifice, Hannah did not go up. She said to her husband, "When the child is weaned, I will bring him. For when he has appeared before the Lord, he must remain there for good." I'm going to stop there. There's quite a bit here about the prayer here. We know that Anna was praying out of deep, heartfelt grief. And in conjunction with her prayer, she makes a vow. That's something you see a lot of in the Old Testament, where people will pray and they'll make a vow. You know, if you hear my prayer, then I'll do X, Y, or Z. Very not something you hear about in the, you know, New Testament that much or among Christians. And I was just, I don't know what to say. I don't know. I've noticed that, and I don't know. It sort of feels like it's wrong, like you're bargaining with God or something.
Yeah,
I
it does
don't
feel
know.
that way. That's what I would think.
But it was very common. Sometimes it was, and you know, there's one verse that comes to mind where Jesus said it's better not to vow at all than to vow and not keep the vow.
Bill, yeah.
And so I think out of fear of falling into that situation, we're very cautious about doing things like that. But she's very faithful. She keeps her vow to the word, to the letter, even though it's very costly to her. I think it's also interesting that this is the first time I think in the Bible where praying in your heart, or as opposed to an audible prayer, is mentioned. You know, like in verse
Yeah,
12.
right.
Because, well, she's moving her lips, but she's not saying anything. And as a result, Eli thinks she's drunk. Which reminds me of Paul when he talks about speaking in tongues, and that when, you know, if people come in and they hear you talking, but they can't understand it, they're going to think you're mad or something like that. They'll come to the wrong conclusion. So Eli says, blesses her and prophesies to her that the Lord will hear her prayer, and the next at the since very shortly thereafter, probably a little more than 9 months, she does have the child. It says that in verse 24, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her along with three bulls, one ephah of flour and a jar of wine. And though the boy was still very young, she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. After slaughtering the bull, they brought the boy to Eli. She said, "Please, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you and prayed to the Lord. It was this boy I prayed for, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. I in turn hereby lend him to the Lord, for as long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." And they bowed low there before the Lord. Work chapter 2, also prayer. And Hannah prayed. And this is the prayer that she prayed is recorded here. And it's a prayer of, I guess you would say, of thanksgiving and gladness. It's not just thank you for giving me this. It's she's rejoicing in the Lord over what he's done for her. "My heart exults in the Lord. I have triumphed through the Lord. I gloat over my enemies. I rejoice in your deliverance. There's no holy one like the Lord. Truly, there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more with lofty pride. Let no arrogance cross your lips, for the Lord is an all-knowing God. By him actions are measured. The bows of the mighty are broken, and the faltering are girded with strength. Men once sated must hire out for bread. Men once hungry hunger no more. While the barren woman bears seven, the mother of many is forlorn. The Lord deals death and gives life, casts down into Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He casts down, he also lifts high. He raises the poor from the dust, lifts up the needy from the dunghill, setting them with nobles, granting them seats of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's. He has set the world upon them. He guards the steps of his faithful. But the wicked perish in darkness, for not by strength shall man prevail. The foes of the Lord shall be shattered. He will thunder against them in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give power to his king and triumph to his anointed one. What's really interesting, and you see this in a lot, in this answer to this prayer was a spiritual revelation to Hannah, in the sense that she had her faith became was realized in her giving birth to Samuel. She had the faith, and then when he was born, there was this realization, personal experience of the Lord, and it was it, the experience was such that it was like it opened her eyes way beyond the level of
Immediate,
the immediate birth. She's seeing things that go all the way to the Messiah. He will give power to his king and triumph to
yeah.
his anointed one. So this experience was really profound, and it's interesting how that works when we have a deep experience because of the exercise of our faith or in obedience to the Lord. When the prayer is answered, it comes, I've seen, with this enlightenment, like where you see the Lord in a deeper way, and it can go very far beyond the immediate circumstances.
Yeah, that's an excellent insight.
Yeah, it's really something. It's transformative, is what I guess you would say. The experience is transformative.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good observation. That she's looking forward to the Messiah.
Who?
Hannah.
What? No, what were you saying, John?
No. Oh, my internet died, I think. No, I said it's a very interesting observation that she's looking forward to the Messiah in her
Yeah.
prayer. Yeah.
Not just looking forward, I think she sees that, I think she sees the answer to her prayer as like unto the resurrection. God, like when Jesus through David says, "Thou wilt not leave my soul in hell," but will raise, he's going to raise him up and exalt him. She's feeling this kind of exaltation, which she likens unto, I think, the feeling that she sees the Messiah having when God raises him from the dead, and then exalts him he ascends into heaven, is exalted to the point of being on the right hand of God.
Yeah.
Oh, what can I say? So, chapter 7, Samuel is now the priest, or at in Israel. I'm trying to get the context of this chapter, where we are. This is after there was a battle in which the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. And after God judged them, they send the ark back to the Israel camp, Israelite camp. And while the people are trying to, I guess when the ark comes back to Israel, it says, the Lord struck at the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked into the ark of the Lord. So apparently, when the ark came, it came into the field, it says it came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. So the people there looked into it to see what was in it, and God strikes them. 70 men among the people. And 70 men among the people and 50,000 men. Now that's strange. The people mourned, for he had inflicted a great slaughter upon the population. So they send messengers to Kiriath-Jearim to say, "Come get the ark. We don't want it here anymore." The men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. A long time elapsed from the day that the ark was housed at Kiriath-Jearim, 20 years in all. And the house of Israel yearned after the Lord. And Samuel said to all the house of Israel, "If you mean to return to the Lord with all your heart, you must remove the alien gods and the Ashtaroth from your midst and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him alone. Then he will deliver you from the hands of the Philistines." And the Israelites removed the Baalim and the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord alone. So Samuel assembles all Israel at Mizpah, and he says, "I'll pray to the Lord for you." They assembled at Mizpah, and they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. They fasted that day, and they confessed that they had sinned against the Lord. And Samuel acted as chieftain of the Israelites at Mizpah. Just before we get into this a little more, this is another thing that you see more than one time, that Jacob, I think, when he was getting ready to cross back into the, after he'd left Laban and was going back at the word of the Lord into the promised land, his wives had a lot of idols and stuff. It says that, in fact, it says Rachel stole one of the household gods. And he tells his wives, I'm going back, we're going back, and we're gonna get right with God now." And he said, "Put all the idols away from you." And it's interesting, that's similar to what happened here. The people had fallen away, they'd taken up a lot of idols, and Samuel tells him, "If you say you want to be the people of the Lord, well, now's the time to repent." And he prays for them, and this is the description then of they fasted, they confessed that they had sinned against the Lord, and Samuel acted as chieftain. In other words, he was guiding them through this. Now, when the Philistines heard that the Israelites had assembled at Mizpah, the Lord of the Philistines marched out against Israel. Hearing of this, the Israelites were terrified, and they implored Samuel, "Do not neglect us and do not refrain from crying out to the Lord our God to save us from the hands of the Philistines." Thereupon Samuel took a sucking lamb and sacrificed it as a whole burnt offering. And Samuel cried out to the Lord on behalf of Israel, and the Lord responded to him. For as Samuel was presenting the burnt offering and the Philistines advanced to attack Israel, the Lord thundered mightily against the Philistines that day. He threw them into confusion, and they were routed by Israel. So Samuel is acting as an intercessor here. He's praying to God on behalf of Israel. They've rededicated themselves to the Lord, and the Lord hears the prayer and he protects them from in this instance. The next, Samuel's praying constantly. In chapter 8, Samuel's going to pray regarding Israel's demand for a king. Because, it says in verse 4, all the elders of Israel assembled and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "You've grown old, and your sons have not followed your ways. Therefore, appoint a king for us to govern us like all other nations." And Samuel was not offended that they want a king personally, but he's displeased that they said, "Give us a king to govern," because he knows that God said he'd be their leader and their king. So Samuel praised the Lord, and the Lord replies to Samuel. He says, "Heed the demand of the people and everything they say to you. For it is not you they've rejected, it is me they have rejected as their king. Like everything else they've done ever since I brought them out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and worshiping other gods. So they're doing to you. Heed their demand, but warn them solemnly and tell them about the practices of any king who will rule over them." And Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. And he explains how it's, they're going to be the servants of this king if they get one. And tells him in verse 8, "The day will come when you cry out because of the king who you yourself have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you on that day." But the people would not listen to Samuel's warning. No, they said, "We must have a king that we may be like all other nations." When Samuel heard all that the people said, he reported this to the Lord. You've got this back and forth. Samuel takes the matter to the Lord as soon as he hears. When he gets more feedback, he takes that to the Lord too. And the Lord reiterates, "Heed their demands and appoint a king for them." And so Samuel dismisses them all, and the next thing we're going to see is that well, we won't hear more about the king until actually Samuel was sent by God to anoint Saul. And we start with this in chapter 9 with the story about how Saul is taken. Was sent on an errand by his father to find some asses that had gotten lost. And he can't find them, but while they're looking, one of the servants says, "There's a seer here, prophet in this area. Why don't we go and ask him?" And Saul thinks that's a good idea. So in verse 9 it says, or 10, Saul said to his servant, "Good idea, let's go." And they went to the town where the man of God lived. And as they were climbing the ascent to the town, they met some girls coming out, and they asked them, "Is the seer here?" And they said, "Yes, he is up there ahead of you. Hurry up, for he's just come to the town because the people have a sacrifice at the shrine today." So they went up, it says in verse 14, they went up to the town. As they were entering the town, Samuel came out toward them on his way to the shrine. Now, the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed the following to Samuel: "At this time tomorrow, I'll send a man to you from the territory of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him ruler of my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hands of the Philistines, for I've taken note of my people. Their outcry has come to me." We've noticed this outcry coming to the attention of the Lord on several occasions already. And here's another one. So God is going to respond and give the people the deliverance that they need. As soon as Samuel saw Saul, the Lord declared to him, "This is the man that I told you would govern my people." In chapter 10, Samuel has to inquire of the Lord again because he can't, when he goes to goes to anoint him, he can't find him because Saul is in hiding. Saul hides himself. I think in verse 22, or 21 says, "Then Samuel brought forward the tribe of Benjamin by its clans." He's doing one of these elimination prize. He's going through this elimination process where God said, and we've seen this in the Bible on, well, I think when we were talking about Achan last time, the sin of Achan in Joshua, remember he had taken
Yes.
the prescribed thing, and it's not like he goes into the camp and says, "And Achan stole it, bring him out here, he's going to be stoned to death." It's like he calls the tribe of Judah, and then they take the one house and they eliminate that, and they keep going down until they come to the person. Exact same thing here. He goes and they don't even know which tribe. They've cast lots, and the lot indicated the tribe of Benjamin. So that it's like he's going through the entire selection. They do this again, and then the clan of the Matrites was indicated. Then Saul, son of Kish, was indicated. But when they looked for him, he was not to be found. So they inquire of the Lord again, "Has anyone else come here?" And the Lord replied, "Yes, he's hiding among the baggage." So they ran over and brought him from there. And when he took his place among the people, he stood a head taller than all the people. I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't want to overly belabor this, but we're going to see a lot of instances where that's the net. At least we can say this: the natural response of Samuel is to call, is to consult the Lord over every matter.
Yeah.
In verse 16 of, I'm sorry, we're at 10. So now we're going to. Saul's been indicated as the king. In chapter 12, what is happening here? I think Samuel's sort of bowing out of the position of prominence here. In verse 1, he says, "Then Samuel said to all Israel, 'I've yielded to you and all you have asked of me, and have set a king over you. Henceforth, the king will be your leader. As for me, I've grown old and gray, but my sons are still with you, and I have been your leader from my youth to this day. Here I am.'" Tested, and he says in his departing words, "Have I defrauded anybody? Have I done anything that you can accuse me of?" And they say, "No, nothing." Samuel then says to the people, "The Lord is witness, he who appointed Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of the land. Come stand before the Lord, while I cite against you all the kindness that the Lord has done to you and your fathers." So he's going to recite the whole history of their experience. I think so as to remind them of the Lord's faithfulness.
Hours into the murder investigation of Elizabeth.
What's that? Okay. In verse 8, it says, "When Jacob came to Egypt, your fathers cried out to the Lord. The Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place." But they forgot the Lord their God, so he lived in the hands of Sisera. So he's reciting this whole pattern of the Israelites crying out, the Lord delivering them, and then them backsliding again. In verse 23, though, he makes this statement: "As for me, far be it from me to sin against the Lord and refrain from praying for you. I will continue to instruct you in the practice of what is good and right. Above all, you must revere the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart." So he's going to continue to function as a priest, but he's not going to take the leadership anymore. He's going to pray for the people and instruct them in the ways that are right. Saul becomes king, and one something happens in chapter 14. Saul's
Yeah,
son
it's
Jonathan.
not long before he's told that he's going to lose the kingdom. It's
Oh
almost
no, it's
immediately.
very quick. It's very
Yeah.
quick. And he starts making numerous mistakes, but it takes a while before he act before the word of the Lord is actually fulfilled. And during that time, he is still the king. And in fact, David, you recall, respects the fact that he's the anointed of God right to the very end, even though he's going after David. He never says, "Oh, well, you disobeyed God, therefore you're not the king anymore."
Yeah.
Even though that is ultimately going to be the fulfillment of God's work, but until God fulfills it, David respects the position.
Yeah.
But in 14, Jonathan's son goes to he initiates an attack on the Philistines by himself with his arms bearer, and it sort of precipitates this all-out battle. Let's see now. So what happens, if I recall now, I just is that Saul charges everybody, all the troops, that he sort of puts a curse on them, that if they aren't to eat any food until he night falls, and he takes and he they defeat the Philistines. But since Jonathan, Saul's son, was not present at that time, because he had started the attack, but he wasn't with the body of the troops, he doesn't know that everyone was enjoined to not to
Right.
eat anything, and he does eat some honey that was there. And it turns out that Saul is
It's
very,
going to put him to death.
he's going to put him to
Yeah.
death, or he wants to, but the troops won't let him do it because
Right.
they say, look, he just is the
Won a
reason we
great
won
victory.
this great victory.
Yeah.
We're not going to do it. But because he didn't keep the vow, God turns doesn't listen to him when he's inquiring. I think that's the continuation in chapter 14. It says in chapter 14, 36, I've got here. Saul says, "Let's go down after the Philistines by night and plunder among them until the light of morning. Let us not a single survivor among them." "Do whatever you please," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us approach God here." So Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hands of Israel?" But this time, he, that is God, did not respond to him. And this is when Saul starts to realize something isn't right. He didn't know that Jonathan had eaten the honey. All he knows is here they're planning to continue this attack, and they're inquiring of the Lord, and there's this breach. He doesn't get the response. And what we find out it has to do with the fact that this vow was or curse or whatever it is, I guess, was broken. He says, "Come forward, all chiefs of officers of the troop, and find out how this guilt was incurred today. For as the Lord lives, who brings victory, even if it was through my son Jonathan, he shall be put to death." Not one soldier answered him. And he said to the Israelites, "You stand on one side, there's another selection. My son Jonathan, I stand on the other." And then he said to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Show Thummim." This is that Urim and Thummim type of thing, like the priests had in the breastplate. It's some means of trying to make of. I don't know exactly how it worked. Some people say the stones lit up in a certain way where it would indicate an answer, that if you an inquiry were made, it would give an answer by this means to the person who was inquiring. But it also says in 42, "Cast the lots between my son and me." So I don't know if it's lots or if it's lights. In any case, they find out that it is Jonathan, and Jonathan says, "Yeah, I did it. I didn't know, but I'm ready to die." And Saul said, "You shall be put to death, but the troops deliver him." I don't know what happened. It says in 46, Saul broke off his pursuit of the Philistines. The Philistines returned to their homes. And that seems to be the end of the matter. It's interesting that God would, that what Saul did caused a break in his communication with God, but that's all that happens. Nothing else. It's not like he doesn't kill Jonathan. There's no further consequence except don't know what that means, except maybe it wasn't the death of Jonathan that God was really concerned with. It was the fact that Saul vowed a vow and then inadvertently didn't keep it. Again, we're back to that idea again.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Where are we now? We're up to, well, so we've got through 14. And Samuel in 15. Samuel's going to be praying for Saul again in verse 11. I see that Samuel says to Saul, "I'm the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people. Therefore, listen to the Lord's command." This is when Saul is told to attack Amalek and wipe them out and not take any of the spoil. Very similar to what Joshua and the Achan sin. Remember how they were told then, don't take the spoil. Saul mustered the troops, and Saul destroyed Amalek, it says in verse 7, from Havilah all the way to Shur. He proscribed all the people, putting them to the sword, but Saul and the troops spared Agag, the king, and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the second born, the lambs, and all else that was of value. They would not proscribe them. They proscribed only what was cheap and worthless. The word of the Lord then came to Samuel, "I regret that I made Saul king, for he has turned away from me and has not carried out my commands." Samuel was distressed and he entreated the Lord all night long. Early in the morning, Samuel went to meet Saul. Samuel was told Saul went to Carmel, where he erected a monument for himself. Then he left and went on down to Gilgal. It's interesting you see Samuel crying out to the Lord all night long because he's told that by God that he regrets having made Saul king. Yeah, I guess he's taking that as sort of a personal failure of some sort, and he's very distraught about it. But in 13 it says when Samuel came to Saul, Saul said to him, "Blessed are you, Lord, I have fulfilled the Lord's command." Then what demanded Samuel is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen that I hear. Now Saul has an excuse. He's saying, "Well, I saved the best, so that I could sacrifice it to God." This is where you get the famous word in verse 22. But Samuel says, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as much as in obedience to the Lord's command? Surely obedience is better than sacrifice, compliance than the fat of rams." I believe that's repeated in the New Testament too.
Yes.
Anyway, that's this is when the prophecy is made very explicit in verse 28. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has this day torn the kingship over Israel away from you and has given it to another who's worthier than you." This doesn't actually happen for years later, but the prophecy is given then. In fact, the next time we hear about prayer is going to be after David is already on. David's on the scene. Saul is still on the scene too, but in chapter 15, I'm sorry, 23 rather. It says right in verse 1, David was told the Philistines are raiding Keilah and plundering the threshing floors. And David consulted the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines?" The Lord said to David, "Go attack the Philistines and you will save Keilah." So David is consulting the Lord. Now the men don't like what David's been told. They said, "Look, we're afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah against the forces of the Philistines?" So David consulted the Lord again, and the Lord answered him, "March down at once to Keilah, for I'm going to deliver the Philistines into your hands." And they go. And David and his men went to Keilah and fought against the Philistines. He drove off their cattle, inflicted a severe defeat on them, and David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. So he inquired twice because he faced some opposition. He got the same answer and he followed through, and it resulted in the Lord being with him and success. In chapter 28, what do we have? This is, I think, the chapter in which Saul is actually killed, because it's after Samuel had died. We see in verse 3 it said Samuel had died and all Israel made lament for him. He was buried in his own town of Ramah. And Saul had forbidden recourse to ghosts and familiar spirits in the land. Okay, this is first of all, Saul goes and consults with a medium, trying to find out whether or not he's going to be successful if he attacks the Philistines. And this is probably because God is not communicating with him again like he did in the past.
Right, and now that Samuel's gone,
So,
there's no access.
His, yeah, so he's going to go to a medium instead.
Yeah, I always find this passage really interesting.
In what do you what could you say on
That
this?
I think it's just interesting that this medium was able to call up Samuel.
Samuel. Yeah, that's
Almost,
perplexed
well, and it's all.
Christians a lot. A lot of commentators really have a problem with that too, because they're saying, well, how could she do it?
Because
Or was it?
he's unwilling. Because doesn't he say something like, "What are you doing that you're disturbing my rest?"
Yeah.
And so it's not like he was cooperating necessarily. It was that she called him. And he was like, "Okay, I'm being summoned.
Yeah.
What's going on here? What's the problem?" And then he's like, "Oh, Saul, what are you doing disturbing me?"
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's very interesting. I tend to take it at face value. I don't think the Bible says that that all of these mediums are frauds. I think we tend to think today in the 20th century, well, they're all frauds. So how could they possibly actually call Samuel up? Because there's no such thing as a medium. They're just tricksters. But there may be tricksters, but I'm not sure that these people who are intermeddling with spirits don't have powers. I think. At least the ones who genuinely are,
Well, right.
involved with the
To
occult.
be any counterfeit, there has to be the genuine.
Yeah. And not that it's good, because we're enjoined not to do that. Very serious. It's a serious thing. That's why Saul had banned all the mediums, because I think he was trying to get back in God's good graces, and that's why he banned them all. But then when he's in desperate straits, he goes to one himself.
Yeah. And so he asks this medium to conduct a seance.
Right.
And then he says, bring up for me the one that I'll name for you.
Yeah.
To which she tries to object. And then he says, no punishment shall come upon you. And
Yeah.
then she goes, okay, who shall I bring up for you? And he goes,
Yeah.
bring up Samuel for me.
Yeah.
Verse 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then what?
Well,
She says in verse 13, and the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. And so he said to her, what is his form? So she said, an old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. Isn't that interesting? And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. Now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? And then Saul said, I'm deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. So therefore I've called you that you may reveal to me what I should do.
And he
And then
says,
Samuel
why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has turned away from you, has become your adversary? Yeah. The Lord has done for himself as he foretold through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your fellow, to David, because you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his wrath upon the Amalekites. It says, tomorrow your sons and you will be with me. And the Lord will also deliver the Israelite forces into the hands of the Philistines.
yeah, that's an interesting line too, right? Tomorrow, your sons will be with me.
In Sheol, which is not hell in the sense that we understand it. It's more like what. It's a place of departed spirits in the Hebrew understanding. And that's what the grave was. It's similar to what Je when Jesus has the par tells the parable about the rich man and the poor man. The one, the rich man's in the place of torment, and the poor man,
Then
Lazarus,
Abraham's
is Abraham's,
bosom.
what they call Abraham's bosom. So there is a division, like in this afterlife. There
Several.
may have been some change of understanding, an evolution of understanding in the Hebrew.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense because I was always confused by that. It's like, okay, you die and instantly go to heaven. Well, then what's the whole point of then on the last day having the
A
great throne
resurrection
of judgment
and
where,
judgment.
yeah. Where, okay, now I'm going to assign you to eternal torment. You're going to, it's like, well, I've already been in heaven, let's say
Yeah.
for the past 300 years. And now
Yeah,
it's like,
what's the point of a judgment?
right.
Yeah.
It's like, now I get to go back to what it's like, I already knew this the second I died. Not, maybe that's the wrong way of putting it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I
It doesn't
understand.
make sense to have an appointed day of judgment in which the whole universe will be judged if you're sentenced immediately upon death. It makes more sense to have a holding
A
place,
holding place, yeah.
like what the Catholics have. What is that called?
It's purgatory.
Purgatory, yeah.
But purgatory is supposed to have a function. It's supposed to be a place where the souls are purified so that they can enter into.
Right. So that's
It's a
not
little
necessary.
different.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's what's going on here.
But yeah, it makes that also this passage can kind of supports that idea too, because it doesn't say that he came down from heaven.
No, came
It
up from
says
the earth.
he ascended up from the earth.
Yeah, from the earth.
That's weird.
That's where the spirits, according to the Bible, that's where the spirits go. Now, I'm not saying that there hasn't been a change because, we're getting into some theology here, but Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So the Lord's not in Sheol. The Lord's sitting on the right hand of God.
Yeah.
So that's where I think people get the idea today that when we die, we go to be with the Lord. The Lord is in the heavenlies, so we are in heaven in some sense. I don't know. I think what you could say is, though, even though you're in heaven, in fact, this is the theological answer. Yeah, well, you may know that you are not damned, but there's still a judgment that's going to I don't know.
Yeah.
It is confusing.
Yeah, I've always struggled with that.
Because
But
we know, even when Paul, even with what Paul says, he says absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. He is acknowledging that we are absent from the body. So it's not the resurrection. When your spirit is present with the Lord, that is not equivalent to the resurrection. There's still a resurrection to be had.
right.
It's a different. And just as you could say with Samuel didn't come up as a body, physical. He had an appearance, but it was a spirit, not flesh and blood that came up to
Right.
instruct soul. Don't know
Yeah,
if that helped.
it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah. So we can stop here. Although, you know what? What are we on? 28? Let's do one more word. I'm going to finish 1 Samuel because the only other instance that I No, it was in verse 30, chapter 30, where David seeks strength in the Lord, because what happened here? While David was he was had been in hiding and with the he had gone to the Philistines and would have been asked to participate in the very fight in the battle against Israel because the king Achish had made him one of his favorite bodyguards, and he was very impressed with David. But I think the Lord intervened there. The Philistine troops say, "No way is this guy going to go and fight," because they knew who he was. And they're saying, even though he's been loyal to you, we don't know that he's not going to take advantage of the situation and turn on us so that he can ingratiate himself to Saul, who he had been fleeing from. So they refused to let him fight. And while he is away, though, David had let his family and the families of all of his men stay in Ziklag, a town, I guess, in the Judean territory. And while they're gone, the Amalekites raid the camp and carry everybody off. And when the men find out about it, they're ready to kill David because that was his fault, so to speak, that this happened. But it says in verse 6, but David sought strength in the Lord his God. So God, David is turning to God when he was in this great danger. It says in 6, David was in great danger, for the troops threatened to stone him, for all the troops were embittered on account of their sons and daughters. And he calls for the priest, Abiathar. And he says, bring the ephod up to me. And when Abiathar brought up the ephod, David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue those raiders? Will I overtake them? He answered him, pursue, for you shall overtake and you shall rescue, which is what he does. And he recovers everything, all the men, all the women. And that is the end of 1 Samuel. And so we can do 2 Samuel next time. I'll put a little note here.
I'm going to stop
And
the recording.
sure.